On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If the movies are America's national dream life, then movie critics are the country's interpreters of dreams, sitting in the flickering dark as if at our elbows, watching, judging, interpreting, articulating what we may only feel. On the way out of the theater, everyone's a critic. But from the days of silent film to the glories of sound and Technicolor to the parade of Hollywood hoopla in the Megaplex today, a few critics have always stood above the rest, delivering insight, lauding the good, thrashing the bad, making sense of Hollywood and our times. A new anthology captures the best of a near century of top critics. Up next on Point, the best movie critics in history and what they tell us about the movies and ourselves. Joining me now from New York is essayist, novelist, and poet Philip Lopate. He's well known for his writing about movies, travel, and urbanism, especially about New York. He watches, by his own count, maybe 200 films a year. He's just edited a major new compendium of film criticism called American Movie Critics, an anthology from the silence until now. Philip Lopate, thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad to be talking to you, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly and resident On Point movie buff, Jack Two Thumbs Up Beattie. Jack, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. Hello, Mr. Lopez. Hi, Jack.
So here we are, a great big film about a great big chunk of time and a huge volume of films. How did you choose who to bring in here? I mean, we see people quoted right, left, and center in all the movie ads these week, Philip Lopate. What makes a movie critic who made your cut for this kind of definitive anthology?
I wanted, first of all, good writing. That was important. And there's a lot of writing that is good enough for a daily newspaper, perhaps, but maybe will shrink when it appears in book form. So I wanted good writing. I wanted entertaining, lively, clear writing that could illuminate not just the movies, but something beyond the movies. So I was looking for essentially film critics who could also double as essayists, you might say.
When you see a lot of movies, you talk to people who see movies, you know how Americans, the sort of range of responses to the critic, describe that range for us. When you say, I'm putting together an anthology of movie critics, do people slap their forehead? Do they want to, like, you know, applaud, start talking Pauline Kael right away and say, oh, I love the critics? What's the kind of visceral response that you get to the red flag of movie critic?
Well, first of all, most Americans consider themselves amateur movie critics, and rightly so, because they've seen a lot of movies,
yeah.
You know. By the time you're in your mid-20s, you've often seen a lot, and then you're bombarded with information from the media about the secret deals, what happened on the set, who didn't get along with whom. So there is a sense of a kind of quasi-expertise. The film critic has to kind of assert some authority in the face of a public that already thinks itself expert, you know. And a lot of that has to do with command of prose style, I think. So I generally encountered a lot of enthusiasm when I told people I was putting this book together because it was a complete vacuum. I don't know why, but there wasn't such a book that would trace the whole tradition of American movie criticism from the silence to the present and really sort of talk about the birth of a kind of profession, a movie critic. After all, it's only 100 years old.
You've got people who do it in a literary fashion, slow and contemplative and writing sometimes long after the films come out. You've got others who do it overnight. Your favorite among them, Vincent Canby. I want to keep the movies themselves in our ear as we talk today. You've got a piece by Canby in there on Easy Rider. Came out in 1969.
Yes, exactly.
It's a terrific piece.
Yeah, and that piece...
Let's just get a little sound of it. I want to get your response then if I may, Philip Lopate. Let me quote here from what you've got from Canby. And he's talking about what he calls a determinedly inarticulate piece at first in Easy Rider. And then Jack Nicholson comes on the scene and he says, suddenly a strange thing happens. There comes on the scene a very real character and everything that has been accepted earlier as a sort of lyrical sense impression looks flat and foolish. That was the big screen coming out for Nicholson. Here he encounters Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper in a small town southern jail.
You boys don't look like you're from this part of the country. You're lucky I'm here to see that you don't get into anything.
Anything?
Well, they got this here, see, Scissor Happy Beautify America thing going on around here. They're trying to make everybody look like Yul Brynner. They used rusty razor blades on the last two long hairs that they brought in here, and I wasn't here to protect them. See, I'm a lawyer. Done a lot of work for the ACLU.
Rusty razor blades, and there's the debut of Jack Nicholson, and Canby calls it, Philip Lopate. It's the moment when the movie kind of comes to life.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that a movie critic has to do, you're inevitably going to see a lot of movies that are pretty mediocre or half-baked, and sometimes there'll be a cameo performance, there'll be a supporting actor, in this case it was Jack Nicholson, that'll suddenly spring a new reality on the film. But Canby, when he begins this review, he says, Easy Rider, which opened yesterday at the Beekman, is a motorcycle drama with decidedly superior airs about it. How else are we to approach a movie that advertises itself a man when looking for America and couldn't find it anywhere? Right away, you know that something superior is up, that someone is making a statement, and you can bet your boots, cowboy, black leather, that it's going to put down the whole rotten scene. What scene? Whose? Why? Man, I can't tell you if you don't know. Now, he's parroting the whole sense of...
If you have to ask how much it costs, you can't afford it.
And also the whole straight hip dichotomy, He's aligning himself with the straights in this case by spoofing the hip, you know?
Jack Beatty, there's Vincent Canby with Easy Rider, and he reaches out and tells you something superior is going on here. Do you look for the critics to do that for you, Jack, or do you want to go in with your own two eyes? Thank you very much.
Well, I do, but it's almost impossible to get those fresh eyes. We're hooked on criticism. I mean, and I resent the heck out of it when I do read a critic who gives away too much. I almost want someone to have a finger pointing. You know, I see this film, but not the Ebert kind of thumbs up, but just this is special, or this is what's special in this film. And just to focus on that and leave the story and leave the surprises and leave that out and just tell me about the Nicholson moments, about the unexpected thing that happens here that I might miss otherwise because of the plot and the story and the rest.
Philip Lopate, the best critics have not, though, made careers of giving away the story, have they? Or have you seen evolution over time there?
No, I think there is a way of dealing with the plot so that you can... bait the hook without necessarily giving it away. But I also think that there's something perverse in expecting movie critics to not talk about the work of art or work of non-art, which you wouldn't do with a poetry critic or an art critic, a dance critic, or someone else like that.
I want to bring our callers in. Of course, there are a lot of moviegoers themselves with their own opinions. From Burlington, Vermont, Jerry's calling. Hi, Jerry, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how you doing?
Well, good.
I really have a deep resentment of critics, not generally. I think what he was just saying was really good. If they just said, this is a great movie, go see it, you know, I'd be a lot happier. I know that's not their job, and I know they're not going to get paid for it.
Give us an example, Jerry. When do they let you down?
I want to give you a very good example. Well, it's two things. But the main thing I'm concerned about these days and irritated about these days is the movie The Da Vinci Code. It's not a great movie. I'm not saying it's a wonderful movie, although it's got a lot of good points to it.
Okay.
I started reading the book, and it was so badly written that I could not read it. I sent an email out to ask friends what the ending was.
And the critics pretty much hated the movie. What did you make of it?
They pretty much hated the movie. I haven't seen any alternative that they didn't hate the movie. I thought it was a very well-done movie, and it was very provocative, and I think the reason... I think they were cowards about this, and it's not the only time I felt the same way about Heaven.
What, they should have said it was great?
They should have given it a better shake than that. I wouldn't call it great, as I said. I wouldn't call it great. But I thought it was a very well-done movie, and I think there was a political and religious reason. I think they were just chicken, frankly. I just think they were chicken.
To say it was okay. Jerry, let us pick it up. Philip Lopate, how about it? Here's a movie that got awfully checkered reviews, pretty bad ones. Jerry saw it. He says it looked okay to him. Is there a place for the okay review?
Certainly. And in fact, the movie The Da Vinci Code may be better than the book The Da Vinci Code, or giving you more pleasure in its own way. It's good of its kind. It does what it's supposed to do. And I think most of the reviews actually said that more or less, but they also pointed out to certain kind of compromises, tediums, longers that were in the film, and that's their job.
You know, Jerry and Jack have been critical here. I have to say, I mean, not that I'll read in advance to get a sense, but I have to say I really enjoy some long-form film criticism. It leads me, much as I've watched and listened and paid attention, I've very often been taken to a new understanding or new way of thinking about what I've seen. That seems to me like the high calling of the critic, Philip Lopate.
Absolutely. You know, one of the reasons I did this book was to pull together a lot of great writing about movies, which is not about the immediate, should I go see it or not? Because most of these movies are old or have been around for a while. Mm-hmm. So it's giving readers the opportunity to see how a film critic works, how that mind takes on a film. And it's not about this life and death Friday night issue of, you know, is this what I should bring my date to see?
Jack, are you ready to hear a little of that, to sort of open the lens with the critic, maybe deepen your own understanding of the film or its context?
Sure, and to get to this, get back to this question of the moment, and the kinds of felicity that can just happen in a film. Pauline Kael speaks to this. She says alienation is the most common state of the knowledgeable movie audience, and though it has the peculiar rewards of low connoisseurship, a miser's delight in small favors, we long to be surprised out of it, not to suspension of disbelief, nor to a Brechtian kind of alienation, but to pleasure, something a man can call good without self-disgust.
Hey, Pauline, come right on over. That's terrific. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a century of movie critics making sense of Hollywood, of our relationship with the movies, sometimes of ourselves. My guest is Philip Lopate. He's editor of American Movie Critics, an anthology from The Silence Until Now, and it is a tremendous collection of really terrific writing. Love or hate the critics. Very often, a good one can just sort of boil it down and tell us exactly what's going on. Here's a little bit from Wes Anderson's film, The Royal Tenenbaums, 2001. Gene Hackman, the great Gene Hackman, plays Royal Tenenbaum, a peculiar father at risk of losing his family. The critic, Manola Dargis, and we'll hear from her later, wrote that Hackman comes across less as a grieving husband and father than like a chief operating officer who's not only accepted the truth of a losing proposition, but moved on already.
Are you getting divorced?
At the moment, no. But it doesn't look good.
Do you still love us?
Of course I do.
Do you still love Mom?
Yes, very much. But your mother's asked me to leave, and I must respect her position on the matter.
Is that our fault?
No. Oh, obviously, we made certain sacrifices as a result of having children, but no, Lord, no.
Then why'd she ask you to leave?
I don't really know anymore. Maybe I wasn't as true to her as I could have been.
Well, she says...
Let's just drop it, shall we, Jess?
Let's just drop it, shall we? Manola Dargis sort of nails it. What's going on there? We'll talk with her in a few moments. Philip Lopate, I wish you'd give us a sense of the spectrum that you've got here from the very early critics and kind of the course of evolution. Begin to paint that mural of how criticism began. It's sort of major chapters. I know it's a tall order, but give us a broad stroke sense of it.
Well, it began with a lot of enthusiastic amateurs, since there wasn't yet a profession. So you had poets like Rachel Lindsay and Carl Sandburg and William Troy, playwrights like Robert E. Sherwood, future filmmakers like Per Lorenz, and they were all weighing in and trying to suggest that there was more to movies than just this trashy escapism for the American masses. And I think probably the first critic who put it all together was Otis Ferguson, at a time when other film critics were bemoaning the juvenile Hollywood product. He saw the beauty of American film, and he saw that there was a genius to the system, and he praised, he got what was so great about Jimmy Cagney and Humphrey Bogart and Fred Astaire and Walt Disney. And during the 40s, you had a lot of kind of sociological stuff going on where people were looking at films as an indication of national character. What makes Americans tick? Why are they? What's the gangster film say about Americans? That kind of thing.
James Agee out front doing that for The Nation in the 40s.
James Agee, Robert Warshaw, People like Siegfried Krakauer doing it about the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And then there was a swing away from that sort of political, sociological orientation towards a more formalist aesthetic approach, saying, look, it's a visual medium. We've got to look at what's on the screen. We've got to look at that rectangle. And it's not all about, the lines of dialogue, you mm-hmm. know. So then you had people like Manny Farber, mm-hmm. who was a painter, is a painter as well as a film critic, a wonderful interpreter of film, and Andrew Saris, who sort of put forward the auteur theory. And in fact,
visual style is clue to moral meaning, and the auteur out front.
Exactly, and this is something that has to be understood, is that these things are braided. It's not just formalism or morality. Somehow there's this connection. Ultimately, you're always talking about morality, and you're always talking about artistry.
And then Pauline Kael comes along, and she says, and you quote her, she sort of raises a flag at one point for even trash movies or what might be seen that way. She says, vulgarity is not as destructive to an artist as snobbery. Now, there's an observation Hollywood could most love.
Exactly. She operated on the pleasure principle, and she was for puncturing the pretension of movies and, as you said earlier, the sort of too facile alienation. And she was also a terrific essayist who really pushed the envelope as far as film criticism is concerned into longer and more complex pieces. And then you had a lot of other interesting film critics, you know, like Molly Haskell, for instance, Dwight MacDonald, John Simon, Stanley Kaufman, which brings us to the present period of younger critics who are still in love with the movies and who refuse to believe that there's been a kind of decline in film, and they're discovering the beauties of new movies. And that's true of people like Manola Dargis and Kent Jones and Stuart Klawans. So it continues. What can I say?
Let's hear from one of the new generation, a really terrific critic. Manola Dargis joins us right now from Los Angeles. She's film critic for The New York Times. Looking at the History of Violence film came out not long ago, and it's the last piece, I think, in your anthology here, Philip Lopate. She writes of Cronenberg, David Cronenberg, the director, fewer directors bother to acknowledge that the canard, it's only a movie, is not only an article of bad faith, but also a deceptively comforting one. Movies, Mr. Cronenberg understands, and Manola Dargis writes, make meaning. They entertain, therefore we are. Manola Dargis joins us from Los Angeles. Manola, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Manola. Did they make you wake up so early for this?
No, I've been working for several hours now.
Oh, good. Here okay. We are in the popcorn line. Manola, how do you understand your job when you go out to do it every day, every night? How do you conceive of it, movie critic?
Oh, well, I don't normally think of it that self-consciously. You know, it's a job. It's a pleasurable one. It's a lot of hard work. Basically, I think the most important thing is that I walk into every single movie with both my mind and my eyes open. I think one of the worst things you can have is a preconceived notion about what you're about to see. And I think that you have to have faith. And I think one of the things that I've often been somewhat dismayed at is that there is an older generation of critics who, having come of age during the 1960s, for instance, really, you know, tend to believe that movies are not what they used to be. I mean, kind of what Philip was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it ends up being a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that if you don't expect to see anything, you're not going to find anything, if you know what I mean.
Do you write to tell your readers whether they should see the movie or to help them understand what they've seen or something else?
Maybe a combination of both. I mean, the way that I think about it, and I've talked to Philip about this in the past, is I really just try to think of the reader as a friend of mine, and, you know, we're having a conversation about movies, except that they don't get to do any talking. So it's basically, you know, but I always assume that there's a certain amount of movie knowledge. I don't expect that they're going to know as much arcane nonsense as I know, but I just expect that I want to say, this is this very cool movie or not a cool movie, and this is why it's interesting, and here's some things to think about. I mean, I really don't have this kind of highfalutin idea about my mission in the world. I just want to kind of spread the good news if there's good news to spread and warn people away from the bad news.
And when you crack the anthology or look back across this big mural of critics, where do you take your inspiration? Do you read critics from 10, 50, nearly 100 years ago and find models there?
I'm sorry. I just missed the last part of your question. Could you repeat?
Yeah. Going back, who do you take inspiration from in the sort of pantheon of critics that Phillips laying out for us here?
Well, one of the things I was really pleased to see was so much attention paid to Otis Ferguson, who I do believe is one of the great unsung until recently, until perhaps with this book, film critics. I find his stuff incredibly lively. I like that he traveled to Los Angeles from the East Coast and punctured a lot of, you know, conceived ideas about how Hollywood worked. And I felt there was a real engagement with the process as well as with the aesthetics.
Otis Ferguson wrote for the New Republic, died, his ship torpedoed while he was in the Navy in World War II. Philip Lope, do you have an example of the kind of thing or an observation on what it is that Ferguson did?
Yes. Here's something about High Sierra, which is the Humphrey Bogart gangster movie. And he says, in the middle of it is Humphrey Bogart, whose conception and rock-bound maintenance of the hard-handed, graying, and bitter ex-con is not only one of the finest projections of character in any story of men in action, but the whole vertebrate structure of this one. A good part of the telling time is given over to his human side, and particularly in the case of the crippled girl he can help but not marry, is slugged a little too hard. But this is a logical part of his life, and it is his life we must be concerned with. He was not betrayed by the spare few he helped and trusted, and it is absurd to suppose that a man who makes his living with an unlicensed gun may not like dogs or need women. In the end, it is Bogart who makes it true anyway, for there is not one minute in this picture when the intensity of his presence is not felt or when he is false or foolish. He is a man you are gradually allowed to hear tick and would not monkey with, a man you feel must be obeyed instinctively and remembered.
There, Otis Ferguson. Of course, he went down with the ship. Let's get another bit of movie in our ear. A much more recent critic, 1997, Kenneth Turan panned the mega-budget love story Titanic. He began his review like this. To the question of the day, what does $200 million buy? The 3-hour and 14-minute Titanic unhesitatingly answers, not enough. Sparked a nasty public feud with the director, James Cameron. We'll hear about that. Here's the villain in the movie, played by Billy Zane, talking with the heroine, Kate Winslet, and her mother, played by Frances Fisher. The lifeboats are being readied.
Come on, sister. You heard the man. Into the boat.
Any room for a gentleman, gentlemen?
Only women at this time, sir.
Will the lifeboats be seated according to class? I hope they're not too crowded. Shut up! Don't you understand? The water is freezing and there aren't enough boats. Not enough by half. Half the people on this ship are going to die.
Not the better half.
Can't sink fast enough, said Kenneth Turan, essentially. James Cameron punched back. Philip Lopez, what about that? Here, we know how popular this film was. I mean,
yes. It
just was giant. James Cameron never gets tired of pushing that in Kenneth Turan's face. First of all, what about that personal feud? And then what about the sort of gap between critical reception and popular reception sometimes?
You know, it's funny, the little section you played, I think bore out what Kenneth Turan was saying, which is it was a screenplay that was the weakness in that movie. It's a fantastic visual spectacle, but a lot of the lines are trite and a lot of the characterization is trite. So Kenneth Turan did what you have to do as a film critic. He called it as he saw it. And James Cameron said, here's a film critic who must be totally out of touch with his audience because this is the most popular film in history. And Turan replied, you know, the fact that it's popular doesn't make it good. And if I were a restaurant critic and you wanted to know where to take your sweetie for your anniversary, I wouldn't direct you to McDonald's simply because more people eat there than anywhere else. I thought that was very witty, actually.
Manola, how about it? Do you think about popularity when you're doing your criticism? Does it factor in?
Nah.
Who cares?
Of course it does.
The thing is, you have to be true to yourself, you know. You have to, and if you're going to start worrying about what the public wants, then I think you're lost. I think it's the death of any, you know, kind of integrity to worry about what other people think, and I have to hold on to my own beliefs and my own taste. I think what is worth pointing out, having written for both the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, I know firsthand how much pressure, you know, Kenny Turan has to face, and I have...
What kind of pressure, Manila? From whom?
Well, it's it's a very there's a huge difference about working in a company town like Los Angeles, you know. And when I was at the LA Times and I worked alongside Kenny, who I consider a friend as well as a colleague, you know, we got a lot more attention. You get a lot more phone calls. You get a lot more hate letters than, you know, certainly I've gotten at the New York Times. I mean,
and if you're tough on them, they freeze you out. They stare you down at the Ivy. What's the?
It's just that everybody knows everybody. You know, and basically what you're doing is you're giving a bad review to a movie in a newspaper that lands on everybody's front door. They wake up in the morning, they pick up that newspaper, and in their own town, for goodness sake. And
in their face.
Right, exactly. That's something that James Cameron, I think, was really freaked out about. Somebody in his own, and the whole company town mentality had been punctured really wonderfully by Kenny.
Let's take a call from Fort Lawn, South Carolina. Sam's on the line. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say I like the movies best where the critics disagree. The ones where they all agree seem to be towing a line. The bad reviews seem to make the better reviews even better. And
so mix it up, have a rumble, and then you can sort it out.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also the Thumbs reviewers gave that movie very good reviews, and not just Thumbs. I mean, if you listen to them and don't just look at their thumbs, you see that they have more to say than that.
The Thumbs guy. guys, I love that. Philip?
Well, Roger Ebert is in my anthology, and I think he's an excellent film critic, regardless of which way his thumb is pointing. But I think that Manola made a very good point earlier when she said that she talks to the reader like a friend. She gets to do all the talking. But Stanley Cavell, who's also in this book, said he goes to his favorite film critics who have the power of the missing companion. So it is like a friendship. And you come to know, as with a friend, their blind spots, their exaggerations, their prejudices, and so on. You forgive them. You read through those deviancies because you really like the persona behind it.
Jack Beatty, do you want the critic to care if the film is popular or not?
I don't want the critic to care. That's one of the problems with the critic. The other problem with the whole endeavor, the other problem is dealing with the highbrow film that comes with a different kind of pressure applied to it, a pressure that the writer, the critic, is going to feel from other people. And the great example of integrity there, I think, is Pauline Kael in the 60s. She worked briefly for the New Republic when Stanley Kaufman went to the New York Times to really pretty much massacre Broadway. And she reviewed Blow Up and called it like she saw it, the Antonioni film. And she just laid it out. And I think it's a terribly pretentious film. Anyway, there was a storm of letters that basically got Gil Harrison at the New Republic to fire her. People were saying, wait a minute, we have a work of art here. Can't you see this, you and your trashy American films? That was integrity.
Pauline Kael's come up a few times, of course, out at the New Republic, into the New Yorker, and a very long run there. A huge splash made by Barbara Streisand, 1968 musical film Funny Girl. It's been commonly said, wrote Pauline Kael, that the musical Funny Girl was a comfort to people because it carried the message that you do not need to be pretty to succeed. That is nonsense, she wrote. The message of Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl is that talent is beauty.
Listen, girl. How? Please, you've got to face facts. You don't look like the other girls.
I know,
you've
but...
got skinny legs. You stick out.
Yeah, but...
And you are out.
Yeah,
Eddie.
I'm just trying to tell
I'm
you
sorry,
something. Why
kiddo.
Don't you just give me a chance? Look.
Out.
I'm going through every time. So
out.
Let it
out.
Look, Mr. Keeney, suppose all you ever had for breakfast was onion rolls. Now, all of a sudden, one morning, in walks a bagel. So, I mean, you take a look at it and you say, what is that? Until you tried it, so that's my trouble.
What's your trouble?
I'm a bagel on a plate full of onion rolls. Nobody recognizes me. Listen, I got 36 expressions. Sweet as pie to tough as leather. And that's 6 expressions more than all them Barrymores put together.
Come on.
Instead of just kicking me, why don't they give me a lift? Well, it must be a plot, because they're scared that I got
Such a gift.
Oh, sure. Let's go.
Well,
Okay, funny girl. A bagel and a plate full of onion rolls, Pauline Kael. Talent is beauty. I thought it was something about truth. But never mind. Ruth is calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi.
What do you know, Ruth?
You
what
asked
like?
What sort of critics some of your people listen to?
Yes.
Well, I listen to the critics on NPR who, especially All Things Considered, who are absolutely reliable. When they say I will like something, I know I won't.
But, bravo. Good for you. Bob Mondello, maybe, I think, does ATC.
I think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
They just sort of all blend into one man who seems to go for the pretentious pieces of garbage as opposed to something that's genuinely and sincerely amusing.
So they're dependable for you, and that's value to you. Who else? Who else?
Absolutely consistent. And the other reviewers I read are in the Wall Street Journal. You wouldn't think of the Wall Street Journal as being, you know, a source for good entertainment. But their movie and TV sections and the weekend thing that they have on Friday is absolutely wonderful for books or movies or television shows.
So a good read and a good guide. There's a vote for ATC and for WSJ, Wall Street Journal. Ruth, thanks for your call. Let's take a call from Wilton, Connecticut. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I think that I like to read the movie critics' reviews after I see the film because, as one of your speakers said earlier, we do consider ourselves amateur movie critics.
Sure.
And I find that I want to see whether or not I did get it or whether or not I think they got it. So that's what I like to do.
So be your own judge and judge after you've seen it. And another call here from Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel's on the line. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi there. I've been watching movies, writing about movies, teaching about movies, teaching about writing criticism for 25 years now, and it's a subject I'm passionate about. I think there's a big problem in both the humdrum movie critics of the everyday newspapers and television stations especially, too many of them becoming flacks for the industry. I think Roger Ebert on The Air has done the profession enormous harm by just liking practically everything.
Too easy.
And then, on the other hand, as the New York Times book review critic the other week, Clive James, said about this volume, that there's too much pretentious intellectual criticism going on over the past 70 years, or especially since Pauline Kael.
70 years, that's a lot of pretension.
A great writer, but a terrible role model, and that she's, you know, full of somewhat pretentious theories that didn't really pan out, and her taste is extremely undependable. Now, that last call, Ruth, I believe she said that she likes NPR critics because if they love something, she knows she'll hate it.
No, she'll like it. If they love it, she'll hate it. I think she was a little more straightforward than that.
I'm not sure about that, but in any case, I think that there's some philosophic, intellectual game-playing going on, like the auteur theory, for instance, which ends up, you know, saying that Hollywood directors working with literally hundreds of people under them and crews constantly changing and screenwriters changing, that they all have a single vision, and that vision can be trusted from film to film.
And you're saying, no way, too big, too gangly.
And yet it held sway among intellectual critics for 30 years.
Daniel, you've put a lot on the table for us. Let's pick it up, including the notion of using some critics, Philip Lopate, as sort of anti-guides. I'm not sure that's what Ruth was saying, but I can imagine a critic who would be a dependable anti-guide here. But what about Daniel's observation? There's been too much criticism that's been too pretentious for too long. I mean, reading in here, I've got to say it's pretty lively, but what about the pretension charge?
Well, I'm not terrified of it. I think that there's a lot of anti-intellectualism in the response to movies, and I'm a pro-intellectual. What can you say? To me, what I'm looking for is a kind of insight that will move beyond the immediate. And just to quote a passage from a review of King Kong when it originally came out, this was by William Troy, and it's an example part of the pleasure in reading about old movies that you can, movies that we regard as classics, we can see how they were greeted in their day. So here's William Troy writing about King Kong.
Yeah.
It was beauty killed the beast, he quotes. By having beauty in the person of Miss Ray lure the great monster to his destruction, the scenario writers sought to unite two rather widely separated traditions of the popular cinema, that of the thriller and that of the sentimental romance. The only difficulty was that they failed to realize that such a union was possible only by straining our powers of credulity, and perhaps also one or two fundamental laws of nature. For if the love that Kong felt for the heroine was sacred, it suggests a weakness that hardly fits in with his other actions. And if it was, after all, merely profane, it proposes problems to the imagination that are not the less real for being crude.
Or another, of course, huge film, Gone with the Wind, 1939, the brave Leslie Howard standing up as critic when this was being, you know, hailed all over the place. Here we have the black poet critic Leslie Howard saying, you know, the commendation of the White South in Gone with the Wind, excuse me, Melvin Tolson, I'm sorry, Melvin Tolson saying the commendation of the White South meant the condemnation of the Negro. We can hail that right here, Ashley Wilkes and Scarlett O'Hara about the happy pre-war days.
Scarlett, you know, you get prettier all the time. You haven't changed a bit since the day of our last barbecue at 12 Oaks, where you sat under a tree surrounded by dozens of bulls.
That girl doesn't exist anymore. Nothing's turned out as I expected, Ashley. Nothing.
Yes, we've traveled a long road since the old days, haven't we, Scarlett? Oh, the lazy days, the warm, still country twilight, the high, soft Negro laughter from the quarters, the golden warmth and security of those days.
Oh, the high, soft Negro laughter of slave days. And Melvin Tolson, Jack Beatty, called it. He stood up and called it when the public just loved it.
Exactly. He did, and he spoke about something that was that continues, I think, in movies, and that is the denigration of African Americans. That is one of the burdens that movies carry. Ralph Ellison speaks to that actually in an essay in this volume, The Shadow and the Act. He says, actually, the anti-Negro images of the films were and are acceptable because of the existence throughout the United States of an audience obsessed with an inner psychological need to view Negroes as less than men. And that continues with what you can almost call the magic black person in movies, you know.
Such as
that terrible prison movie with Tom Hanks. What was that called? Whatever that was called. Oh, the Green Mile. Green Mile, where this is literally magic black man. And it's another evasion, I think, and another way of stereotyping and dehumanizing African American.
Philip, our reel is about to come to an end. Golden age behind us or more to come on the critic front?
Oh, certainly more to come. And I hope that this book will help sow those seeds.
Well, we hope so, too. Really a rich and deep collection here from front to back, a huge work to put it together. And we thank you for that, Philip Lopate. And we thank you very much for being with us today. It's been just terrific.
Thank you.
Philip Lopate, essayist and novelist, editor of American Movie Critics, an anthology from The Silence Until Now. We go out with the music from Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves. Paul Rudnick, the comic screenwriter, reviewed it under his pseudonym, Libby Gelman Waxner, a celebrity-obsessed Jewish-American princess. He wrote, I have often wondered, Jack, he wrote, what would have happened if instead of having my own room with a canopy bed and a Snoopy phone in Great Neck, I had been kidnapped as a child by Indians and raised as a Sioux. Now, thanks to Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, I have my answer. A boy named Sioux, he called it S-I-O-U-X. Jack, thanks for being with us. In a moment, internet fans of the upcoming action movie Snakes on a Plane. This is On Point. One summer movie, Snakes on a Plane, coming out in August, is already getting a lot of buzz.
Enough is enough. I've had it with snakes.
Starring Samuel L. Jackson, the upcoming thriller is about what you would expect from the title. And even though it is yet to be released, it already has a community of fans online and has been the subject of parodies and homemade fake trailers. John Fine is media columnist for Business Week magazine. He's been writing about the snakes on a plane phenomenon and joins me now from New York. John, thanks for being with us. What's that by your foot?
I
Oh, no.
Back, John, back. What is going on out there in cyberspace with snakes on a plane?
Well, what is going on is really kind of a delightful audience response to a movie that really on its face is just so deeply absurd that, you know, this is the only conceivable reaction is ridicule. What happened was bloggers got a hold of the title, and it just kind of, you know, became this thought virus that people got obsessed with, and people started making jokes about it, and they made a catchphrase about it. You know, snakes on a plane means kind of, you know, what can you do or stuff happens. and so they're doing all this stuff, and it eventually, you know, you have enough people doing it, it takes on its own life. And we're in a networked world where people can see all of these, you know, these videos and these trailers and these joke interviews with Samuel L. Jackson. And what ends up happening, and what ended up happening, and this is what's really interesting, is that New Line Cinema, you know, heard about this, and they didn't try to step in. But they watched very carefully, and when they saw that people were inventing dialogue for this movie, they actually incorporated some of that in reshoots. I wish I could say what that line is, but I fear we'd be, you know, stretching the bounds of appropriateness for radio.
But they've taken the people's line on this, snakes on a plane, and we're told they put it in the movie. Let's get a sense of what's going on out there, John. Here's one of these, an audio trailer spoof of Snakes on a Plane, been making the rounds online.
Gentlemen, I have already solved the problem. We do not need any weapons. We have snakes.
Snakes?
Yes, snakes. First, I will put my army of snakes into a box. And then I will put that box on a plane. Then I will release the snakes. And there will be snakes on the plane!
John, fine. Okay, I don't know if that's Austin Powers Evil Twin or what. What? So this is just somebody sitting in their bedroom with their computer at home and making it happen.
That's basically how all this has happened. You know, this harks back somewhat to around 8 or 10 years ago. There was the Blair Witch Project, which also got a big boost online. There's a very clever ad campaign that kind of blurred whether or not this was a documentary or not. Obviously, the Blair Witch Trial, which was about, you know, the search for this sort of, you know, legendary ghost story in the woods in Maryland, that was not actually a documentary. But it was a good campaign, and it got people talking. What's happening with Snakes on a Plane, though, is dimensionally different. You have people participating in the marketing itself. And not only are they participating in the marketing, by New Line picking up on what they're talking about and incorporating it into the movie, they're kind of participating in the making of the movie itself.
So there's kind of dance going on here. With the Da Vinci Code, Sony did a bit of that. I mean, there was an uproar. Mm-hmm. They kind of came to own the uproar by putting up a blog and said, talk about it here.
It's a neat little bit of, you know, marketing jujitsu, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, where, you know, they essentially gave people a space to air their concerns. And, you know, by the way, that also becomes a marketing vehicle, you know, for the movie itself.
And now we get all these venues online, MySpace.com and all the rest. You quote, who is this? Flanagan, saying if you get to express yourself, you might end up putting together something, frankly, more compelling than studio ads.
Well, I mean, how many terrible movie trailers have we all sat through?
It seems like the same three guys narrate all of them.
Well, exactly. In a time when, in a land where...
In a time.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that you and I can sort of do one off the top of our heads, you know, indicates the kind of bankruptness of the form. The delightful thing about media right now is that it can be a lot more participatory. This is terrifying if, you know, you create and sell media for a living. But if you allow yourself not to be freaked out about it the way that New Line was, and they just sort of essentially invited these people in and didn't do anything to stop them, you know, you can get a big bang out of it. I mean, Snakes on a Plane probably would have died a very quiet and, you know, well-ridiculed death at the box office when it debuted, you know, 5 years ago. I would say it actually has a chance of becoming this kind of weird sleeper hit. I mean, I can't wait to see it, even though I know it's going to be terrible. I mean, it just sounds too good, you know, not to miss.
And now been brought into the popular patois, Snakes on a Plane, Stuff Happens. Donald Rumsfeld will probably be using it soon. We heard a clip from nutsaflame.com earlier. Here from youtube.com, a clip from a Snakes on a Plane fan film, Snakes on an Elevator.
Hey! Moses! I can't feel...
Oh, my God.
There are my... on this elevator.
Snakes On an elevator. I'm gonna show up when they string all these fake trailers together, John.
Don't forget Snakes on a Bicycle. I think the true test for, you know, whether an idea is truly great is if it's scalable. And Snakes on a Plane is certainly scalable. What can I tell you?
Ooh, scalable Snakes on a Plane. We got scales all over the place. John, you're terrific. Thanks for bringing it to our attention. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
John Fine, media columnist for Business Week magazine. The real Snakes on a Plane is due out August 18th. We'll go out with a musical spoof of the movie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's as good as gone. I've seen some stupid movies, but this is just wrong. Snakes on a plane. I did not ask for. Now they're crawling all in my coffin. Oh, it's appalling. They won't get off me. There's got to be much more to it. This can't be a movie. Oh, it's too damn stupid. Take some play.